There's a lot of conversation about the father's side of it, but not a lot about the mother's side.
You sort of put mothers on a pedestal, and not that many don't deserve it. And sure. I am a mother myself, so I understand. There's this piece that we don't talk about, and I think was just this silent thing that we constantly swept under the rug. Our family in particular, the household neglect was the piece that really elevated, escalated everything for us. My mother has these challenges on her personality, like very self-centered, so she doesn't really have that capacity to pour into her children, to care about your feelings. We're there to take care of her.
Does that make you bitter in that kind of a situation?
It was a bitter phase, and I think that was what I was going through, was like grieving the mother I'd never had. To not have that, it was a sense of anger.
Welcome to today's episode of Falling to Freedom, where addiction ends and faith begins, the weekly podcast that brings thoughtful, informed, and challenging discussions about addiction to the forefront of everyone's minds. We join our host now, Chad Lacombe, for today's topic.
Well, today we're joined by Dr. Bridget Petit. She is the professor of psychology in the School of Behavioral Health at Loma Linda University. And she's recently written a book, Dis in parentheses, Honor Thy Mother, Dysfunction.
Daughterhood, Dysfunction, and Deliverance.
Daughterhood, Dysfunction, and Deliverance. Just came out recently, a few months ago. So we're going to be talking about some of the things in that book, and specifically how childhood experiences, you know, can affect, you know, addiction and all kinds of behavioral problems. So I understand that a big, you know, influence on the book was your own personal experiences, which I would expect that, you know, with people writing from their personal experiences. So if you wouldn't mind just sharing a little bit about your, you know, story as it relates to this, and then we'll kind of get into the conversation.
Yeah. So I'm also a licensed clinical psychologist. I should put that in there as well. Yeah. So I also work with people who've had traumatic childhoods. So I've been very interested in it from a lived experience, but also working with people and helping them sort of heal and recover from the things that maybe have been part of their foundation growing up. So for me as a psychologist, a lot of times we're not really supposed to talk about our personal side and our origin story. It's supposed to be very clean and neat, but our stories aren't, you know, they're very messy. Oftentimes our backgrounds inform why we go into these professions. And for me, this is a story that I wanted to tell for 20 years. As a person who studies adverse childhood experiences, it was really important for me to help people understand sort of how do we get to these adult difficulties with our health and our mental health and our addictions. What is the pathway to that? And so I wanted to really not only look at my life, but also supplement that with looking at other de-identified stories of, you know, folks who have suffered and experienced traumatic childhoods. In particular, the book focuses on mothers because they're very foundational in terms of our safety and security as children, our formative years, you know, that caregiver role is so instrumental. And I think we are very comfortable talking about dysfunctional fathers.
That was my first thought. I'm like, you hear a lot about fatherlessness and just fathers that are acting like fools, but you don't really hear a lot about the moms.
So it's a very taboo topic, but I thought it was important because, you know, when that sort of unhealed, important caregiver is raising children, that has a lot of detrimental outcomes. And we talk about, you know, all the other societal factors that contribute to stressful home environments. But my clients were coming to therapy talking about their relationships with their mothers and the continued strain that went on into adulthood. So adverse childhood experiences, maybe just to give a little bit of, of background of what it is. Is originated with a Kaiser study about 30 years ago, talking about a series of abuse, neglect, and household dysfunction. So abuse, typically what you think about, physical abuse, sexual abuse, and emotional abuse, which is maybe one we don't think about as much. And then neglect, so emotional and physical neglect. So not providing psychological safety, neglecting whether it be educational, medical, you know, emotional needs of children, and then household dysfunction. So we're talking about substance use, domestic violence, incarcerated parent. And one of the more common ones is parental separation or divorce. Mm. So ACEs are very prevalent. About 60% of people have at least one or more ACE, with parental separation and divorce being one of the more common ones.
Do you know a number on that? I'm just curious. Yeah. Like, statistically today, like how much? What's the divorce rate?
The divorce rate, I think, is like in the 40s. Like, I think it's a little less than it used to be from what I'm hearing. Like,
yeah,
it's
not. I thought it would have been higher than that.
Yeah, you would think. But I think people are being more cautious and getting married and taking their time, it seems, in some cases.
Sure.
And then I think you would just know a little bit more about not getting married young sometimes and the things that make it risky, those risk factors for divorce. So I think it's less. They used to say 50-50 all the time, but I think if I'm recalling correctly, it's slightly less than that now.
Well, I guess that's good news.
Yeah, it's good news.
Yeah. Okay. So you had a childhood that included some of these things?
I did. So I had about 8 out of 10. When I tell my colleagues this, they're like, oh, you're just being, you know, you probably had 10. But I think for me, it's like, if we're sticking to the hard questionnaires of the ACEs study, for me, you know, my immediate family was incarcerated, but my mom's third husband came out of prison into our household. So like visiting him in prison and so forth. And that was kind of the pattern. Like, she would then you found another, you know, partner after that who also came out of prison directly into our household. So for me, I don't count that because I didn't think of them as family, just because I kind of started emotionally separating from that parental role. They didn't really have a role in my life in the same way, I think, is
you grew up young.
I grew up very, very, very young. Very young. And so, you know, my siblings and I, we really had each other to lean on. You know, we had our grandparents who just lived right across the railroad tracks that, you know, we could at least eat and, you know, have some supervision. And so that was like a nice buffer for us. And then as we got older, you know, my grandmother started inviting me to church and, you know, picking me up and, you know, taking me to different church events. So I was very active as a teen in my grandmother's church. And
where did you grow up?
I'm from Ohio. Okay. I'm from Ohio. So I'm a Midwest. Yes. California transplant. Yeah, so, yeah. So definitely was, you know, more slower paced and, you know, I think
which is not a bad thing.
It's not a bad thing. I think that's a protective factor for me is that, you know, it was like, I grew up and there were decent schools. And even though, you know, a lot of things were happening in our household, our neighborhood was safe. And, you know, so it wasn't the same risk as other people who might have been in, you know, in cities and communities that aren't safe outside of the home.
Right.
Yeah.
Or having family that are just distant.
I mean,
it's nice when you can have family that close and can come together. It seems like nowadays it's like, grandparents live maybe on the other side of the state or even another state and siblings, everybody's just kind of spread out. So you don't have that, you know, support.
I grew up with my, you know, I think I have 23 first cousins just on my dad's side. And, you know, we all pretty much grew up in the same town and went to high school together. And, you know, a lot of that was definitely a protective factor for us.
Okay. So you're not only a professor, so you're teaching psychology within the behavioral health sciences at the school, but then you also have like a private practice.
So I haven't been in private practice here, but mainly supervised out here in California. But I have had private practice in the past in Ohio.
I would imagine that helps.
Yeah, it does. It really informs.
Rather than just book knowledge, rather than just learning, it's like you have this firsthand experience.
Absolutely. And that's what I wanted this book to be, to bring all of those pieces together. I didn't want it to be unreachable for the layperson. I didn't want it to be a resource for, you know, those who are training to be therapists and clinicians and counselors. And I really wanted to bridge that. So it's really a hybrid book that can be used in the classroom to really do a deep dive into adverse childhood experiences, maternal maltreatment, and those controversial things that just beyond the textbook that we don't often get as clinicians.
So Loma Linda is a Christian university. Yeah. So, I mean, me being a Christian and, you know, our recovery ministry is faith-based. I would imagine that influences you to some degree when, as you view clients and you know, problems that they're having and solutions, does that influence you? Or
it absolutely does. And I think, you know, I think on two sides. So I think about how it's been a protective factor, religion, and how we can, you know, keep youth off the street and safe. And, sure. you know, that, and, but then there are things that I think sometimes can be a challenge where sometimes we maybe miss addiction or those hidden mm-hmm. addictions because we're sort of masking it behind faith. Mm. We've got the scripture, we've got the, sure. you know, we're at everything, we're, you know, we're sort of performing right. Christianity, but then there are these cracks. And I think as a psychologist and someone who researches addictions, sometimes I see those cracks before other people do.
Okay.
So I think about a time when I was visiting a church with my husband's family, and one of the elders came in, and he was late and disheveled and disoriented. Mm. And he kind of stumbled up on the stage, and I was like, oh, I was like, he's struggling with addiction. And I was like, no, he's just tired. I was like,
I recognize this.
And months later, he's like, remember that guy that you asked about? Like, yeah, he's in rehab right now. And I'm, you know, so it's, I just have a different lens. And sure. I think sometimes people are able to mask some of their bad behaviors mm-hmm. behind religion sometimes.
Sure.
Or, you know, it's so taboo sometimes in our mm-hmm. communities that we don't talk about it. You mm-hmm. know, I did a women's ministries program, and they asked me to talk about substance use, and I was talking about how sometimes people will cope with substances to get through the holidays, the stress of being with family and mm-hmm. all the planning, all of that that comes together, just comes to a head at that time of year. And so I was talking about unhealthy coping, and it's like, yeah. oh, we tend to, people are drinking too much sure. and, you know, doing other.
A little bit too much eggnog.
Right? A little too much eggnog that, you know, the frequency, it's all kind of, mm-hmm. those holidays are back to back to back. Sure. And, you know, I remember the presenter behind me said, oh, we don't do that. We don't.
Probably had a bunch of ladies come yeah. up afterwards.
Exactly. Like, thanks for saying that. Right. Yeah. And so it's like some people's experience is just different. Other, you know, mm-hmm. as far as what they see, you know, and it's mm-hmm. It's sort of a sterile maybe view of what's happening in the church. And, sure. You know, I'm more able to see those cracks and yeah. see the risks and see the, you know, the opportunities really to, right. You know, not just sort of sterilize what people are going through in their personal mm-hmm. lives after they leave the church parking lot mm-hmm. or in the church parking lot, as I know in some cases. So,
sure.
yeah.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, one of the big visions for this podcast was understanding that addiction is a whole of society problem, mm-hmm. right? Sometimes people just think, well, it's just other people, or it's just yeah. a certain demographic or socioeconomic Absolutely. Group or something like that. And it's not the case. Absolutely. And we have a little saying that addiction is the dirty little secret that every family deals with, but nobody wants to talk about.
Absolutely.
Because even if it's not in your immediate family, mm-hmm. it's probably in your extended family or really close to that.
Absolutely.
But people don't want to talk about it because of the guilt and the shame mm-hmm. associated with it, especially within the church.
Within the church.
Want to put on this, you know, I yeah. got everything together yeah. and they don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
But it seems like the best thing to do is talk about
Absolutely.
It and to understand you're not the only one going through it.
Absolutely.
Other people are. And if you want to work through this, the first thing is you got to be open and honest about it. Mm-hmm. So
Absolutely.
That's what we try and do, is get different voices.
Yes.
People that have gone through it, family members, mm-hmm. subject matter experts like yourself, and just kind of try and broaden this conversation. Yeah. It's really been eye-opening for me as well, some of the conversations that we've had,
yeah.
you know, because I have my own personal experiences and then knowledge that I have gathered,
yes.
but it's just broadening as I have these conversations with
right.
people. So
Absolutely.
I think it's all good.
It's a big field, and, you know,
oh, yeah.
it's so much information to take in. I mean, I even think about working in a health sciences institution and think mm-hmm. about the doctors and nurses and health professionals who have access to these medications. You know, for
oh,
me,
they're not exempt.
They're not exempt,
no.
right? So it's all around us.
Well, that's the thing. Like when I've talked to law enforcement,
yes.
they're not exempt.
Yep. Yep.
You know, professionals
Lawyers.
Are not. Nobody's exempt.
No one is
you
exempt.
Know, so it's like, yeah.
yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe you want to just kind of talk about that maternal side of it and
yeah.
the research that you've done, and if your own personal experiences
yes.
come into it, because I think you're right. There's a lot of conversation about the father's side of it,
mm-hmm.
but not a lot about the mother's side.
Yeah. We've sort of put mothers on a pedestal, and not, mm-hmm. not that many, you know, don't deserve it. And
sure.
I am a mother myself, so I understand the challenges. I understand, you know, the stressors that come along with that. I think in my case, my mother was, you know, technically a single mother. So it was,
mm-hmm.
that's even, more challenging to do mm-hmm. it by yourself. You know, I say it's difficult. I have a partner, and you know, we struggle with our children. So, you know, definitely don't want to take away from the burdens and the challenges that come with parenting. Mm-hmm. But there's this piece that is, you know, that we don't talk about, and I think mm-hmm. was just this silent thing that we constantly swept under the rug mm-hmm. in our family in particular. And you know, it was sort of the household neglect was the piece that really mm-hmm. escalated everything for us. So, okay. you know, someone finally made that CPS report and said, you know, this is unacceptable for these children mm-hmm. to live in these conditions. You know, you're talking about in Ohio in the wintertime without, you know, electricity or heat or running mm-hmm. water or, you know, and we just sort of pretended when we left out of the house mm-hmm. that everything was okay. You know, I was active in school, did well in school, was in cheerleading. You know, you mm-hmm. wouldn't think that that was the environment that I was coming home to. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, even more than that. It was really the emotional side, I think, for me, that my mother is sort of has these challenges on her personality, like very self-centered. So she mm-hmm. doesn't really have that capacity to pour into her children, to care mm-hmm. about your feelings. It's like, we're there to take care of her. Mm-hmm. And as the oldest daughter, that kind of became my role. I was the de facto mother mm-hmm. in the household for my younger siblings, you know, taking care of them, raising them, making sure they did have food or clean clothes or whatever I could do with my limited resources to take care of them in the, you know, space of having an absent mother.
Does that make you bitter in that kind of a situation?
It used to. Mm-hmm. It used to, because, you know, well, first it was guilt. Like, I think when I kind of escaped and left and went to college, I felt guilty. Mm-hmm. But then there was a bitter phase. And I think mm-hmm. that anger is the normal part of grief. And I think mm-hmm. that was what I was going through, was like grieving the mother I'd never had, the mother that I think mm-hmm. everyone deserves. And to not have that, it was a sense of like anger that, mm-hmm. that came with that for me. And then, you know, it started to come to light that there was more going on than just a, you know, working mom, you know. So mm-hmm. I tell people this, it was kind of flipped. You know, I'm in school and, you know, doing the programs. And they're like, oh, you know, the cigarettes are the gateway drugs mm-hmm. and the marijuana, the, you know, and you're like looking out for all of these peer influences. You know, people are going to mm-hmm. offer you these things. And it was really just seeing my mother's purse, and it was like, oh, why do you have, like, oh, now you're smoking. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And then she's kind of what the teenager would say is, oh, I'm holding for a friend. Right. So it was such a flip, because I was just in a parental role sure. from such a young age, you know, and then it was like, oh, what are these green leafy things in a bag, you know, and like mm-hmm. not really fully understanding, you know, what drugs were, what they looked like, mm-hmm. you know, just knowing like, sometimes she's off and she smells funny and she, sure. you know, something's just not right. Mm-hmm. And then honestly, it really took until I went to college where I really realized the extent of it. I had a good friend and she wasn't feeling well, and she mm-hmm. came to my room, and I had this little, it's like the bag that your sheets and things come in when you get the little plastic bag. Mm-hmm. And I had like just all kinds of cold medicine and cough medicine and, you know, all the things. And so they started calling me the pharmacy in my door, which I was like, doesn't everybody have this? And my friend that I wasn't feeling well, she's like, no. And her dad was a physician. And I'm like, you would think you would have all of this stuff. And it kind of just clicked. Like, my mom had this whole bottom drawer, like the biggest drawer in her dresser, and it was just full of like prescription pills and, you know, things she'd taken. I thought it was normal. Yeah. I thought it was normal. My mother was in a healthcare field. She had been a medical assistant when mm-hmm. I was younger. Mm-hmm. So it was always under this guise of like, she is, you know, a health professional, and, you know, mm-hmm. it's okay. And she knows when you should stop, when you don't need to finish that dose. And she, you know, knows. And, you know, I remember thinking at one point my grandmother was in pain. I was like, well, you don't have any pain medication? She's like, no, your mom took it. And I'm like, what? You know, so it's like, it just like started to unravel sure. very slowly for me. And I think, you know, small town, naive, mm. I didn't really know a lot. We were kind of, I say, sheltered, for lack of a better word. Mm. But then it kind of became my mother would sort of want to be the cool mom. So it's like, if she couldn't be the good mom, then she wanted to be the cool mom. So it was like, oh, inviting us to drink with her, inviting, mm-hmm. you know, my brother to smoke with her. And, you know, and it was kind of that, like, she was going to flip it if she couldn't be good in a traditional sense of loving and supporting and caring. This was like going to be another angle, another way to like win us mm-hmm. over, to have this shared, you know, experience. Mm-hmm. You know, fortunately for me, because I had my grandmother, I always say I had the three G's God, granny, in graduate school that really helped me conceptualize all of this and protect me from, you know, the pitfalls. I was really scared that, you know, when we talk about gateway, right, that that was going to be me, and I didn't really have the strength to stop, you know, an addiction. So for me, it was like, okay, you know, full stop, like, this is not a path that I want to go down. And then because of the dysfunctional relationship with my mother, part of my effort was to, you know, be perfect, right? That, that be perfect, and my mother will love me, right? If I do everything just right, if I take care of the kids, if I, you know, take care of the house, if I get perfect grades, if I'm in the activities, if I do all those things, she will love me. And, you know, at some point I realized it didn't matter. It wasn't about me.
Do you think
all.
You interpreted the neglect as she doesn't love me?
I think at the time it was like my brain was conflicted. I mean, I was probably 16 or so, where it was like really realizing, oh, she doesn't. She only cares about herself. I don't think I had the language of, you know, narcissism and narcissistic abuse until grad school. But it was like this mismatch of what society and family. I knew something wasn't right. I didn't feel loved. Yeah. And I think, you know, I would see her. She could express love, but it was usually like performative, or, you know, like, oh, in front of other people, or it was not, it just never felt genuine. Yeah, it never felt genuine. Yeah, you got it.
So when it comes to neglect, what would you, I mean, I would imagine there's a wide range.
Yes.
Right? So there's on the extreme end where, you know, parents are just taking off, leaving their kids and not doing anything. But what would be like the other end that would actually be considered an adverse childhood experience?
Yeah, so I think, you know, maybe the other end of the spectrum of neglect are parents who are traveling all the time for work and they're never there.
That's kind of what I thought, like a parent that works all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So they're not there to support them, to be there for them for the hard days, to encourage them in the good days. And I think a lot of times people confuse providing with, you know, like, well, I kind of neglected you because I was a provider, but there's that sort of a physical thing that's not the emotional support that children also need in addition to being provided for.
Yes. I know in my life, I mean, my own experience, that was, I idolized my dad, right? Yes. But he was working, doing his own thing, and it just seemed like never had enough time. And, you know, there in, right, you know, junior high, end of sixth grade, seventh grade, I just started like seeking other friends and approval and got myself in a whole lot of trouble that didn't turn out well. So I can definitely see that. Yeah. So how big of a role do you think these ACEs or adverse childhood experiences play in leading to addiction?
Yeah. So we know there is a high correlation, and when we say that, there's a relationship between, you know, how many adverse childhood experiences you've had and adult outcomes. So, you know, first they started looking at this, like, physical health, like cardiovascular disease, high, you know, diabetes, stroke, and all of these sort of physical issues, and then also we started to look at the typical ones that you might see: depression, anxiety. We see people who've had traumatic childhoods then end up in adult situations that are also where they have traumatic experiences as adults, and in direct correlation. So you think about the substance use as one of the adverse childhood experiences. So having a parent in active substance use, that is using, or even in the household, how that influences you in adulthood. So part of my past research and dissertation was on intergenerational transmission of substance use. So like the more people in your family, so if you're like in this drug culture where it's like normalized and not stigmatized, right? We very much, you know, my mom, like I said, my mom started trying to party with us and not parent us. And it was this thing that we really hid from, like, my grandmother, and that, you know, outside of the family, it because of the stigma, right? So it was just a different world that that we were in and exposed to. And in that world, it became normalized. So, you know, it almost became like I was judged because I didn't partake. You know, they would do things like, you know, we couldn't have a simple card game because they would start smoking and try to blow the smoke in my face to give me a contact high. You know, so it's like I can't even physically be here because, you know, the influence is, you know, that I don't want to be exposed to, that I don't want to be around, that I have not chosen for my life are just, you know, present and, you know, intentional and normalized, and I'm sort of, you know, seen as an outsider.
Well, because and it probably made them feel guilty.
Absolutely. Yeah.
They'd feel more comfortable if you were doing it with them than sitting there not doing it. It's like they would, condemnation on themselves.
Right. But then they would talk about me and say, oh, she's not so perfect. See, she's doing it too. Like that would be the, that would be the other side of it. So there was no, exactly. There's no winning for me. And in my mind, it's like, okay, I have to do what's best for my life. And I can't live based on, you know, your approval or disapproval or, you know, who you think I should be, or you trying to find cracks, because I'm not perfect, right? And, you know, they would just try to find cracks. And so any, it was like ammunition. So anything that I did that was slightly, you know, oh, remember when? Oh, you know, and it would become this thing because they were just trying to take me down a peg and hold me back and not just let me go and live and, you know, have my life. They just felt better with me kind of being in that with them. And so it was hard to kind of shake that off.
Sure. So you mentioned your family. How many brothers, sisters? How big is your family?
Pretty big. So I have one older brother, and then I have three younger sisters. Okay. So it gets a little complicated. Right. The oldest three, we have the same mother and father.
Okay.
They divorced when I was about 5 or 6 years old. And then my mother remarried and adopted my biological cousin. So then she's my second sister, and then my father remarried and had a daughter, so there are five of us in total.
Now, you know, without getting into all of their details, did they kind of go down that path, or did they choose the path you did?
No, I would say my brother was more influenced as the golden child in the family. He wasn't, I think, seen as much of a threat to my mother and her life, and so he definitely was in that life with her. My younger sisters are, I would say, more so experimental social type users, and but have not like fallen into like addiction, like substance use disorder type of spectrum. And I think probably the faith element has something to do with that. Like I think for me, coming into the church was really I think a protective factor for me from some of those things. So I don't know that my brother has gotten into anything heavier, you know, with my mother. I think because we were children, I didn't really know the extent of things. Like I said, it kind of came in these little bursts of insight and, you know, rumors of, you know, how far it went, but I don't know that to be true. And her seemed to have gone a little bit further than in my brother's case. So
So you mentioned something about, and it kind of piqued my curiosity because of a podcast that I just did, and I think I mentioned it to you about transgenerational, you know, behaviors and things. So I believe that we are spirit, soul, and body. And so, you know, we have these three parts of us, and they all are working together positively and negatively, right? And so I did this podcast recently with a molecular biologist talking about epigenetics. And we did talk about that, how there's actually a physical component to our behaviors that can be passed on to our children negatively. But it can also, it's not permanent, right? It can be changed. And so these epigenetic markers, but I would imagine that it's also on the soulish side, the psychology side, behavioral stuff that can also, I'm assuming that's what you were talking about when you said this transgenerational, I forgot the exact term you used.
Intergenerational.
Yeah. So maybe you could kind of talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I, you know, so the epigenetic side more talks about the biology, and you, in psychology, we have the nature nurture debate, and it's not so much a debate anymore, as we know both factors contribute to our outcomes. They, it's intricate and, you know, fuzzy and overlaps quite a bit. But for me, I more so look at the environmental causes. So like I said, if you are in a family where substance use is normalized, where it's, you know, a social, you know, part of social gatherings, part, you know, we kind of become socialized within that, that that's just normal. Everyone does this, right? We don't necessarily have that perspective of, you know, outside of our family. Like there are families that don't do that. This is abnormal. This is, you know, not something that everyone does. And so our early perceptions of how to have fun, mm-hmm. how, you know, even what drugs are and what they aren't, you know. So for example, I can remember my younger sister, the adopted sister, doing a class project on drugs, and my mom was getting upset with me because I was telling her that marijuana was a drug mm-hmm. for her project. And my mother was like getting upset, like, it's not, you know, this is before legalization, any of that sure. came into the conversation. And it was like, she couldn't even handle like a factual discussion of this project that I'm trying to help my younger sister with. And it was, you know, really, I think for her, like, to, you know, justify, you know, what she was doing, but trying to, you know, balance, okay, what's happening in our environment? And then outside of that, here are the challenges that come with, you know, substance use. It's really trying to educate my younger sister about, mm-hmm. about the truth and realities of that. So I think, you know, for some people, you may be more likely to engage in substance use, particularly like mm-hmm. alcoholism and so forth, mm-hmm. because of your family history. Mm-hmm. So my family, it's very strange because it sort of skipped a generation, if you will. Like okay. my great grandparents, there's some history of substance use. Of course, that's long before I was born, so I don't know mm-hmm. the details of it. I've heard alcoholism. I'm not 100% sure. My grandparents went sort of like, we're going to do the opposite, like super religious, mm-hmm. strict. You know, we're going to do everything right. We're going to raise our family right. You know, all of that was just off the table, like mm-hmm. completely. And then I say my mother just kind of reached back two generations, like, this sounds great. This is, you know, this is something I want for my life, and kind of just, mm-hmm. you know, I was like, so she chose chaos. And I know it's more complicated than that, but it was just like, that's not what she saw in her household mm-hmm. at all. You know, so it was like for her to take it and then mm-hmm. take it to the extremes that she did. It was, you know, it was just challenging to watch. And so, I think for families, it's, you know, understanding, you know, our basic human behavior, our basic way we learn mm-hmm. is through modeling. Mm-hmm. So we copy what we see. Mm-hmm. So I've had people, you know, criticize my siblings, or, you know, oh, I can't believe they went, you know, some of the other ways they went down mm-hmm. similar paths and had challenges in life. And, you know, I'm like, I perfectly understand why they are the way they are, why they do what they do, because that's what we saw. Mm-hmm. You know, there was, you know, and because we weren't allowed to talk about it, and it was like the secret, right? Mm-hmm. So you didn't have like other people know, they didn't know what was going on, so they couldn't really tell us. So there's mm-hmm. another way. And so I think, you know, that they kind of modeled a lot of things. Now, some things they didn't model, they kind of, you know, I say I'm really proud of my sister who's behind me, and, you know, she really turned her life around, like stable employment, mm-hmm. you know, raising her kids and so forth, and said, you know, I'm not going to have that for my children. Like, my mm-hmm. children won't go through what we went through. And, you know, it's still a long journey to kind of change your mind and, you know, grow and, you know, just change it. I mean, at a cellular level of like mm-hmm. where your reward pathways are and mm-hmm. how you, you know, where you seek thrills and excitement or peace, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and where the substances have filled that for a lot of people, trying to find alternatives can be very difficult, but also very rewarding.
When you say intergenerational, you're mm-hmm. talking about just behaviors that are being modeled from mm-hmm. generation to generation mm-hmm. for, you know, the next family,
the
you
next
know?
Family, the next, the children, the grandchildren, the, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think part of it is that we can't disentangle like what part of that could be genetics, what part of that, sure. you know, but I do know, you know, it's like the twin studies they do, and some will go on to use substances and some won't, you mm-hmm. know? So all of that matters.
It does.
So you're never exposed to it, but it's in your DNA. You can still go down that path. It's not
we have a free
DNA.
Will.
Yeah, we do.
We have a free will. And yeah. so things can yeah. definitely influence us, but ultimately each person has to make that choice, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
That's why, like, even in your family, you got, you know, you chose one path, maybe another sibling chose a different path yeah. in that same environment, right? So each person has choice.
It doesn't mean it's not hard, though.
Absolutely. For sure. And it was interesting because you were talking about, you know, that reward system. And that was actually a part of the conversation that, you know, I had where, you know, there's the dopamine and the serotonin in our brains. And we seek, you know, to find those sometimes in unhealthy ways. Absolutely. You know, so very interesting. So what, you know, as far as we're talking about addiction, right, and we're talking about these ACEs, and you said, what'd you say, 60% of the population, you know, maybe even higher,
has
some of these?
Yes.
So what can people, what you know, advice would you give to people, you know, if they have grown up, let's just say a different range of, let's just say, for now, let's just say like more on the adult side, not, we'll talk about, you know, the youth in a second, but more on the adult side. If you know you've grown up and you were in a chaotic situation, maybe you've already kind of been struggling with, you know, unhealthy behaviors and stuff, what would your suggestion be to that person?
Yeah, I think one of the best first steps, we say, even in addiction, we say recognition is sort of the first step, right?
Sure.
Acknowledging, understanding, being able to name it, to name what happened. I think, you know, to destigmatize, like talking about mothers and talking about what they've done, you know, we're quick to recoil. Oh, they did their best. They tried, you know, they fed you. And we can't sit with, and also this was abusive, and also this environment was problematic. So I think getting the language for what happened to you is a great first step. And, you know, I encourage people, you know, of course, through therapy, that it can be a great tool to help people make sense of how it has affected them. Because I think sometimes people don't realize that the extent that it has affected them. So they think, okay, well, I stopped doing these, I didn't do these certain bad things that I didn't like, but they're still doing other things, right? And they're maybe minimizing the harm that that can cause, not only in their life as far as their health behavior choices, as, you know, substance use, you know, physical health, all those things. And, you know, just owning, you know, this is where I am now. And I do have the power to change that. I think part of it is, you know, reflecting and, you know, making those connections. I say, I'm at this big age, I still find moments where I'm like, oh, that's really, that's still deep within me. And to be able to call that out, to talk through that, to, you know, process with a therapist or, you know, other trained health professional, whether it's a, somebody even in clergy that you might feel comfortable with who's trained in mental health. Like those are amazing resources to give you outside perspectives to really think through and process and try to retrain your brain in a way to find healthy replacements, right? Because you're still with that quote unquote fix, but to have it in a healthy, productive way. Like what are ways that we can, you know, improve our health, our life, our mental well-being. I hate to use the word journey because everyone always says about a journey, but it really is. It's not something that is done overnight. It really takes intense, deep work. You know, it's something that you can achieve. And I think that's the point of my book is that, you know, not to say, oh, everybody should go on to become a psychologist. That's not the point. The point is like, you don't have, your past doesn't have to define you. That doesn't have to be how you live your life now. So even for me, like making conscious choices about who my children are going to be around and what they're exposed to, sometimes that's not popular, but unapologetic in protecting my children from.
You're in trouble if you're as a parent trying to be popular.
Yeah.
You're not going to be doing your job.
Absolutely. Yeah. Doing that work. And I think it even requires an extra level of deep work if you have children. To break that pattern is deep work, you know, and it is not easy. I'll say, like, my brain is wired to be this certain kind of mother, the kind of mother that I had. I didn't have, you know, I had a grandmother, but I didn't have that mother figure. So I would find myself having to hold back and let my frontal lobe kick in and let me respond how I want to respond, what I know as a psychologist to be a more healthy way. And that doesn't mean I do it perfect every time.
Absolutely.
But it's a practice. It's okay, when I feel like this, I need to do this, you know. And really trying to parent in a different way requires just other levels of energy and active and intentionality. And a lot of my church family that I was around, you know, when we had our, when our children, we had our children in Ohio, the other mothers that I would just see like, oh, like nurturing and patient and all the things I, you know, I was like, that's not my strength, you know, like to sit and play this little, this Barbies for 40 minutes. It's like, feels like an eternity. But to watch how patient and creative and loving and forgiving mm-hmm. and, you know, caring and uplifting they were with their children. So the, mm-hmm. these other moms in the church, you know, even though they were my peers, I was looking to them like, how do we do this thing? How do we, mm-hmm. you know, so those healthy models really were beneficial for me.
Sure. Yeah. So it sounds like step one, you got to be honest with yourself.
Yeah.
And I've observed that there seems to be no limit to our ability as humans to rationalize and justify stuff. You know,
we are really good at defense mechanisms. Oh, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of defense mechanisms. Yeah, we like to play the mind games.
So the advice is, if you're listening and that's you, first just stop, be honest, mm-hmm. you know, think, be honest about the stuff. I would imagine, you know, it's probably a little easier to point out your dad's faults than it is your mother's faults.
Yes.
So if that's a situation, it can be really difficult. You know, you don't want to, probably internally, you're thinking, I don't want to shame her. I don't want people mm-hmm. to know these things.
Absolutely.
So what about with, you know, children? Mm-hmm. So if you have children that are dealing with these things, mm-hmm. they're probably still in that kind of a situation, mm-hmm. right? But, I mean, what do we do? So I guess it's not really what do they do, because they really can't do much.
Yeah.
Probably can't ask the parents to do anything if they're mm-hmm. part of the problem. So mm-hmm. what can we do as society? What mm-hmm. are things that we can try and encourage and offer, you know, to address these things before they become, you know, bigger problems?
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of it is, you know, if we can work with the parents. So I think a lot of times we put burdens on children to fix things that they're out of their control. So, sure. you know, we do need to think about that first. It's like, what can we do to support the parents, parenting mm-hmm. classes, you know, mm-hmm. Rehab, those kind of things that can really help with the parenting side. But I say for children, we know that positive childhood experiences mm-hmm. are kind of the anecdote. Okay. So, you know, when I mentioned
coaches,
grandparents, the aunties, mm-hmm. the, you sure. know, like to be there for them, to listen, mm-hmm. provide that emotional safety, to provide that, you know, those physical comforts, like, you know, food and clothing, and those things go a long way, removing them from the environment. So, you know, my grandmother would pick me up and take me to church and, you know, just to pluck me out of that environment and, sure. you know, put
and
me
you think
somewhere
she
else.
Knew it that she probably knew at that time, right?
I do. Yeah. She
I mean,
did.
She's doing it as a protective thing, right?
Yes. I think they, you know, they put a lot into me because I felt like I was the one they could save and I was the receptive to all right. the stuff.
But she's got the best chance.
You know, but it was how you value education. Like, she does well in school. So it's just our values. Mm-hmm. I wish someone had done that for my brother. You know, he kind of had the opposite. Like, I remember a specific gym teacher who I won't name. I don't know if he's alive or not. But I remember him telling my brother, well, you miss so much school, you might as well drop out. And I just was like, you know, because why would you say that to a child as an educator? That just blew my mind. And knowing that my brother and I were side by side in this, like, mm-hmm. you never said that to me. You never said that I might as well drop out, because I was the one like trying to make up the work and get the assignments and, you know, and pressure to go to school. And so the teachers, the coaches, the encouragement, you know, the church family, mm-hmm. the, you know, just getting people out of that, getting the kids out of that environment mm-hmm. so they can see something else. Right. They need to see something else to know that it's possible for them, to know that they can do something else. You know, I looked up to my, you know, third cousin twice removed, you know, who was like, you know, a professional. I'm like, okay, like, a professional, she's doing it. I don't want to do that, but I can be a professional. I can, mm-hmm. you know, have a career and a job and, you know, stability for my kids.
Sounds like there was some hope.
Yeah, there was hope
there.
Yeah, that's a great way to capture it, that, mm-hmm. you know, I felt like there was a path for me, mm-hmm. And fortunately, in my case, it was rewarded mm-hmm. from other people and other environments, school, sure. education, sports, you know, my grandmother, that was really what helped me, you know. And mm-hmm. then I think there's also a little bit of, you know, building up that grit, that fight in kids, you know, mm-hmm. you don't just have to kind of settle and resolve and kind of accept what's happening to you. And I think for me, it was early on realizing something is not right. And I mm-hmm. began to resist my mother, and I began to stand up and, you know, no, I don't want to do that. No, I don't want to go there. You know, at some point it was, no, I don't want to live with you. You mm-hmm. know, just like standing up for myself and protecting myself when she wouldn't mm-hmm. or couldn't. And, I think building that up in kids, building their voice, inner voice, building their self-esteem, mm. their self-worth, you know, is so important for them to kind of go on and be able to continue to do that work in adulthood.
Mm-hmm. Is there, in your experience, is there like an age or even a range that is kind of like the critical time, right? Mm-hmm. Of course, there's no time where you're past the point of no return.
Yeah.
But it seems like there might, at some age, mm-hmm. you know, these are the really formative years. And I mean, if you yeah. have the ability to influence your children or even a relative, I mean, maybe you're mm-hmm. in, maybe it's a situation where the parents, they're you know, far gone, and yeah. the child has no way to remove themselves from that situation. But right. maybe you're connected to the family mm-hmm. as a sibling or aunt or uncle or mm-hmm. grandparent, and you want to, you know, try and help, mm-hmm. you know, by like what you said, you know, hey, can I take them out for ice cream or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, what is that age where it's like critical, because yeah. at this point, you know, it's, things are starting to solidify. Is there one?
Yeah, so I'm not a child psychologist, so I always preface okay. my answer that this is more lived experience and maybe anecdotal from what I could give an educated hypothesis. Okay. I would say like 8 to 12 would okay. be that late elementary, sure. early middle school, where, you know, the peers haven't quite got a hold of them, the influence, and they're old enough to know something's not right. And, mm-hmm. you know, old enough to kind of process this different experience and, you know, a little bit of separation from the parents in terms of like independence and not necessarily relying on them for everything like you mm-hmm. are when you're a young child. I think for me, like, I remember it was kind of like a girls and boys club, and they had mentors from the college, you know, that would come and pick us up and take us for ice cream. And, you know, and you know, like I said, with, you know, going to church and things with my grandmother in middle school, like those for me, I think it was probably more effective then than had it been if someone tried to intervene when I was like a late teenager. Sure. I think so. That would be my guess.
Sixth, seventh grade.
Yeah, probably sixth, right around grade. There.
That would be my best guess.
Bridget, we just want to thank you for coming on.
Hope you're very successful in, you know, your efforts and in your teaching. And I'm just, you know, I'm glad you're a believer and your faith infuses in there, because, you know, we are spirit, soul, and body, and it's a part of the equation, right?
Absolutely.
So we have to take that into account. So thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being a part of this much-needed conversation as we expose the raw truths about addiction. Don't forget to like, follow, and most importantly, share. Remember, addiction is the dirty little secret that every family deals with, but nobody wants to talk about it.